episode 28 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey everyone, how are we doing?
Two-time store champion and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Hi, how's it going?
2015 store champion and the best-dressed man in Netrunner, Hollis Echo.
That's against the rules. The creators will be angry.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals top 8 competitor. Now, Liam wasn't here last week when we did our Dextravaganza, so we thought we'd give him the time of day and let him talk about something he'd been working on recently. So, Liam, what Prasad brew have you got for us this week?
I have something quite cool. So what I've been playing is kind of a build on that Goodbye to You list that propped up Netrunner DB. That was the, you know, favorite of the week and blah, blah, blah.
Was that the Chaos Theory list?
Yeah, it was the Chaos Theory list with Au Revoir and Snitch. So it took 10 influence from Au Revoir and Snitch and basically played self-modifying code and test runs to put together a very, very quick Au Revoir Snitch engine and use it to generate, you know, around three credits per run or 3 credits per click, and then use that as an economy to power a standard mid-range shaper list. I really liked it. I really liked that shell. I really liked the idea of stacking an economy in this way and putting together a very modular style of play that lets you build exactly as large as you need to and then compete with a corp regardless of how long they want to go in the game. There's really no corporation that can access up to 12 credits a turn inspired in the same way that I'm sure basically every other runner was. I took 3 Au Revoirs and 2 Snitches and said, okay, where can I put this?
And you landed on, you wanted to put it somewhere where it wasn't going to cost you 10 of your 15 influence?
No. So I decided pretty quickly that I was going to put it in the criminal. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And actually, Brian, the other half of this list, the way it was coming together, was discussion that we had in the car trip back from Ballarat. We were talking about Doppelganger.
Oh, that's right. We were talking about the cost and the playability of it.
That's exactly it. We were talking about Desperado and Doppelganger specifically, and the way that a credit from Desperado isn't necessarily the same as the extra run from Doppelganger. And this is because a click is your tangible resource. A click as a runner is always your most fundamental resource. And when you use a click for credits, there are lots of ways to do that. If you have Au Revoir Snitch, you can use that click to gain 3 credits. If you have Magnum Opus, you can use it to gain 2. If you have Professional Contacts, you can use a click to draw 1 card and gain a credit. So Doppelganger gains you a run. That click that Doppelganger gives you, that fundamental click in a run as a standard cost that Doppelganger gives you, scales really wildly, which is something that Desperado doesn't really do. Desperado scales with respect to how many runs you want to make in a turn, whereas Doppelganger scales with how strong your click economy is.
So Desperado is really more fitted to, well, is at its best in an aggressive deck where you can make lots of runs per turn, right? And really leverage the...
Maybe aggressive isn't the right word there. Maybe proactive is the word. Any deck that's looking at some point to turn from any game plan whatsoever into making 3 to 4 runs a turn, Desperado was going to be fantastic in. But I wanted to use Au Revoir and Snitch, and Au Revoir and Snitch don't require you to make successful runs, whereas Desperado does. At the same time, I wanted to have a competitivity in the early game, as most criminals do. You still want access to things like security testings. You still want access to things like John Masanori, if that's a card you want access to, or Data Sucker, which all requires successful runs. So I was thinking to myself, well, how do I bridge this gap between wanting to make unsuccessful runs and successful runs? And this conversation that we had inspired me. It was Doppelganger. Doppelganger was the way to bridge unsuccessful and successful runs. I could declare a server with testing, make my run there, get my Data Sucker token, get my 2 credits, trigger Doppelganger, and then sneak into a server, take a peek, jack out, and get 3 credits. And so that was the core economy package that I wanted to look at in this deck. I want it to be very flexible. I want it to come together in a lot of different ways. And I want it to be very scalable. And so this is a silhouette control deck that's very flexible, very scalable, has a lot of selection in its card power. Its card draw engine is in Mr. Lee. You see two of those cards, you say, well, am I facing an aggressive deck or am I playing a control deck? Do I want to play for the early game or the long game? And you can pick the card that best suits that. So it's really flexible in that regard, and I'm really happy with this list.
I put this list together as well and had some testing games against Jesse a couple of weeks ago. While I admit I obviously haven't played the list as many times as you, I wanted to ask you though, because I ran into a snare when I was playing it. I wanted to know how you got around it. I felt when I was playing it that I wanted to have Mr. Lee in my opening hand all the time, mainly because you need to get your pieces together because you want to be able to make these excellent runs and you want to trigger your doppelganger for value, as we're talking about. The issue I found was that when I didn't have Mr. Lee, unlike when you're playing the cake control list, which we're very into here, when you don't have your professional contacts, you can still sort of develop your board and you can sort of draw cards and discard programs because you can recur them. You don't have that flexibility in this list. Do you find that same issue if you don't have a Mr. Lee? Does things just crawl to a glacial pace for you?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some considerations to make here. The first is that as essentially a combo deck, because it's a long game shell, but you are putting together so many different cards here and they do need to come arranged in a specific order. Because of the limitations on memory, I have been able to get around this a little bit by playing a Cyber Solutions memchip, which means that you can play out some of your programs, some of your non-icebreaker programs. But the way I intended on actually hosting this memory was on Jin, that feisty fellow from the core set, and that is because the Djinn can fetch the Data Sucker, the Medium, and the Nerve Agent that let you pressure servers when the time actually comes. You can also use Djinn as a very cheap way in the other game to start hosting those Au Revoirs and Snitch. Whereas if you used a Cyber Solutions memchip, you would lose simply so much tempo that you would never actually be able to come back into the game. But at the same time, the cost of getting out of poverty traps is sometimes that you need to put your cards together in strange orders. And if the cards don't come together in that right order, you might call it variance, but frankly, it's just a cost of running the deck. If the cards don't come together in the right order, you can't do very well at all. So yeah, that's certainly a cost here. Mr. Lee helps you order those cards perfectly because he sees so many cards in one turn. And so you have a lot of flexibility in that regard, but you still need those cards to come together in the right order, which is definitely a limitation on this deck. There are lots of ways around this, obviously, like the economy. All the economy cards are interchangeable with each other, like Daily Cast and Sure Gamble aren't really that different. It's just a matter of playing all of them so you reach that critical mass. The cards that aren't interchangeable, though, like the breakers aren't really interchangeable. You always need one specific breaker, or the inside jobs aren't really interchangeable with anything else, because there's no real way for you to break into a server when you don't have that breaker, which is also not ever redundant. Another limitation I found in the deck that has been a little bit trying is actually the card Snare. Incidentally, you don't have any recursion. And because my influence is so pressured, because there are simply not many great sources of memory in faction without relying on a console, my influence is very pressured in that regard. So I haven't found space to splash influence into recursion. And if you cop a snare and you discard a breaker, you will not have that breaker. And that's just how this deck goes. And that's a big deficit. You've got to choose your battles with these things. This deck has been wildly successful in control matchups with Replicating Perfection or with Hasbyroid Midrange, or even some of the slower Glacier decks that are coming out of Wayland with the ice, although that might just be Wayland faction.
Hollis, you did some testing against this list recently, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I had the pleasure of actually playing against Liam, but also playing against some of my online friends, so that are my IRL friends.
You played against Liam via the power of the internet.
Via the power of the internet. Every time I've played against his deck, I've exclusively played it using RP, because it felt like if I played like any fast advance deck, it was very likely I could try to race it and get there. And I mean, the split was with that, you know, it was pretty common that I'd be able to snuff out the win versus that particular archetype. But it's the long game that I'm having the biggest problem with. I think a deck like that ramps up so much with that amount of credits that even if you have this guaranteed scoring remote where they don't get to access, the fact is that they're absolutely getting into the central they need fairly consistently. At that point, really, there's not much you can do. It's akin to playing something like a Stealth Andy deck, where they actually pay so few credits for their one run that they care about that you're pretty much guaranteed you're not going to actually stop him from making a run every turn, barring, you know, heavy amounts of barriers or something like that. A similar scenario here is, as opposed to being dependent on stealth credits to make runs efficient, the actual activity of viewing the ice that's there, getting the knowledge of exactly how that server's set up, and then gaining a heavy amount of credits as a result, means that you gain knowledge, but also the actual economy necessary to get through whatever is installed. So I think it's very, very hard to play that particular deck when you're running any kind of like a RP or HP or maybe this Wailing Glacier deck that doesn't really exist. It just makes it very tough. Actually, Liam, for you, what have you noticed versus your matchups for fast events decks? Are you noticing they're noticeably more difficult by comparison?
Oh yeah, it's awful. It's absolutely awful. It's just another one of these 80-20 decks that I've put together, right? Like, I have a match against Wilfie the other week. Yeah, basically, because he knew what I was doing on turn 2 or turn 3, he just put an agenda behind a remote, and I couldn't interact with it whatsoever. And then he put another agenda behind another remote, and that time I did have the inside job. And he was like, cool, you've got 2 points. Try and race me. And he just started racing me again, and I just died. Yeah. Look, if someone's out there going to race you, you just don't have that capacity. In many ways, I think this is kind of a shape of formats in general, where we all kind of converge our decks to the center, to the upper center. People tend not to like aggressive strategies as opposed to mid-range or slower mid-range strategies. And so we kind of converge on this portion of the play space where between the middle and between the top end, we just kind of flow back and forth, and the format kind of flows back and forth from mid-range decks gradiating all the way up to these RP lists. And look, every time the metagame focuses too much on the slow end, decks that are going to be hyper aggressive do really well. They pop up in this kind of binary fashion. Every time they see the format focusing too far on the top end, they pop up at the bottom, and all of a sudden they do very well because people just can't compete with them anymore, and they force the format to recenter and force the format to be just more middle-grounded, more mid-range. And control decks like this are the same, and they would do very well if the meta was focused on being aggressive and gradiating between being mid-range and being very aggressive. And every time the format got too aggressive, they would pop up and take advantage of that hole in the metagame. But that's just not really how people play, and that's fine. This is how a game's developed. So.
I guess the thing with that is that mid-range decks, or, you know, using that term to refer to decks in the middle of the speed spectrum, not necessarily whether they have mid-range attributes, but, you know, decks in the middle kind of easier to tune week to week. Like, aggressive and controlling decks usually are much more dependent on synergy, so you kind of have this core of cards which go into an aggressive deck or a controlling deck, regardless of which, you know, side or which idea you have, and it's not as easy to tweak cards, you know, as you see the meta shifting in some direction. And so I guess that's one of the reasons why people, I think in general, probably prefer mid-rangier decks, is that they naturally let you use more of the good cards or whatever. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but and so maybe this experiment of trying to build, you know, a deck as far to one side of the spectrum you can go, you know, with this silhouette control deck, and also the next design deck that you
and
talked
also,
about
I played
a couple of episodes ago.
I built a, because we built a Extreme Glacier Fast Advance list back when the box was spoiled, and that was basically as far in the slow spectrum as you could go for Corp.
But yeah, so like maybe this is sort of a way to try and test the limits of, you know, how is there some sort of synergy that we can make that is good enough to outweigh the fact that by being so far to one side, you have to give up playing some of the good cards which don't necessarily mesh with your strategy or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think by choosing to be so aggressive or so controlling, eventually you have to come back to this question that you actually posed a few weeks ago, Wilfie. That is the question of power versus overall synergy.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I was trying to get at. That.
Yeah, absolutely. And in so many ways, like, choosing to be hyper-aggressive, regardless of how you do it, is choosing to be synergistic over powerful. you know, decks like that certainly have the capacity to exist in the space and be successful in the space. I think, though, I think you're absolutely right in this regard. Mid-range decks, when you take them into a room and things seem a little bit off, you make a tweak. Aggressive or controlling lists, they're so one-sided, so binary in the way they separate their opponents into winners or losers. You don't take them into a room and make tweaks. You take them into a room and you put them down or you pick them up. That's how you do it. You have the list set in stone. And then you decide to play it in the same extreme fashion that these decks play out.
Yeah, I guess maybe we can look at it as linearity, like rather than necessarily on this aggro mid-range control spectrum, if you want to see it that way, is that a very linear decks basically have no room to move, and you're just kind of trying to deploy your game plan, and what your opponent is doing is kind of ancillary to that. You're just trying to ignore it and do what you do as much as possible, whereas, you know, more interactive decks or less linear decks kind of have more room to change as the meta changes because you care more about what your opponent is doing. That might be a good way to describe it.
Yeah, and this is something I've certainly learned over the past few months, trying to push the limits of the game, that the further you are to one side of the middle spectrum, being, you know, a Crim deck focused around Siphon and being a Shaper deck focused around contact or around events, like, there's lots you can do in the middle of the spectrum there. But the more you push to one side, exactly what you're saying there, Wolfie, the more linear you become. And the more linear you are in your strategy, the less you can interact or the less hope you have when your opponent actually can engage with that very linear strategy. And, you know, sometimes they will just kill you. And, you know, like very linear, hyper-aggressive corp decks or very linear, very slow corp decks. If they have the appropriate answer, if they have the breaker for your hyper-aggressive deck, or if they have, you know, the parasite or the shutdown or the siphon train for your hyper-slow deck, yeah, they'll just get you. No question about
that. That's enough of that talk, Liam. We're not really in the business of losing games of Netrunner on this podcast. Now let's just move along. We also wanted to speak a little bit about remotes in the remote server. We've mentioned this, sort of hinted at it a few times over the past few weeks, about wanting to have a bit more of an extensive discussion about the remote server, how to analyze the remote server as the runner, and how to build it as the corp player. So, Liam, you've been, again, doing quite a bit of thinking about this. Do you want to get the ball rolling?
Yeah, the context has really moved, and they've done a fantastic job, I think. Like, Lucas and co have done a great job moving the focus off centrals and back onto the remote, where it seems like their game always wanted to focus. And, you know, like, Sansan and the Biotic kind of moved it away from that. But those cards, while they haven't lost the juice that they've always had, there are now competing strategies that do utilize remotes. And I guess something that I've been thinking a lot about lately is something Jesse has been really heavily emphasizing when he was talking about corp interactions and corp economy. The way he's been thinking about economy and the way I've been thinking about remotes have kind of meshed here. When he thinks about corp economy, he wants to run the runner through the remote as many times as possible. And it's because the corp scoring is such a difficult task. It's so far-fetched just to think, how can I have this agenda on the table for a whole 2 turns and do literally nothing but invest in it and hope that the runner doesn't just take it off of me. All they need to do is see it. All they need to do is get into that server. But at the same time, you know, you can bluff in the sense that you can put things in there and threaten to win the game with points and make them run through. So that remote can do a lot of taxing work for you, even if you don't actually intend to score agendas out.
This comes into the concept of opening a scoring window, right? By bluffing someone to come through your 2 or 3 pieces of ice and draining their resources, that can open that 2-turn window that you need to score that 5 for 3, right?
That's it. But it also leans at a notion that I think is very crucial in Netrunner that we don't seem to focus on enough, and that's called conditioning. And conditioning is when an opponent is treated the same way over and over and over until they're given a mixer-upper. And that's the idea of conditioning. When you send them a mixer-upper, when you ask them a new question, they won't really know how to answer it. It's like showing them the same slide over and over again. What's the answer? Blue, 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 blue. And then you show them red, and they're like, oh, it's blue. But the answer was red. And I know it's completely contrived, but it's what we're trying to do here. It's what we're trying to do with our remote. Our remotes will tend to be relatively easy to access. Maybe it costs 4, or maybe it costs up to 7 credits. and that they'll have the breakers to do it, because for us to develop that remote and not simply die to the race, we needed to allow the runner to acquire the breakers or take the time that it needed to acquire those breakers, or else they'll just kill us with a medium or a siphon train or something. So they can basically always access it after a given point in the game. So if they can basically always access it, how can we as corps make them run low in their economy, low enough to give us an actual window to score remotes, to score agendas in? And the way is to just feed them agendas, or feed them traps, or feed them Adonis campaigns, or feed them Jackson Howards until they're
left. Feed them upgrades.
Feed them upgrades, yeah, absolutely.
Upgrades are so good for this exact kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And it's only until recently we've got some even more powerful upgrades, like CyberDex Virus Suite. And people saying, like, oh, CyberDex Virus Suite is a very good card, but it's a bit narrow because what happens if your opponent's not playing a Data Sucker, or what happens if you're not playing against an Anarch?
Whatever, it's
face and that card down. Is still fantastic. You put it face down in there with another card that they know is an Ash or something like that, and they're like, well, shit, that might be an agenda.
Yeah.
I'm going to go in there and, well, no, I mean, sure, the thing's going to fire, but it's still this perfect use outside of a...
That's it.
Outside of a matchup where its full ability is going to be relevant.
It's like, you know it's useless. Do they know it's useless? No. Good, they're going to run it then. Fantastic. Dude, the other night I saw a server with 4 cards in it. They were all upgrades.
That was against me, I'm pretty sure. That was against me.
It was me.
It was because I had Ash, CyberDex Virus Suite, and, oh, there's something else in there. It might have ended up being the Adonis campaign, because I remember the look on your face when you got all the way in there, and you were just, you were so shitty.
You trolled me hard.
Yeah,
though, right?
I trolled you like 3 times in a row. And then
you know what was going through my head at that moment.
What?
Never gonna give you up.
I think we can also look at the way that the corp cards are actually kind of centered around trying to avoid using too many upgrades or assets. It feels like the strength of a lot of the operations in the game are meant to sort of counterbalance the strength of certain assets. Like, I feel like there's so many decks right now where the focus is great operations as opposed to great assets, to where there's actually in corp decks there's less cards that people are playing. And again, I'm only looking at it possibly from that tier one perspective. There's just less cards, I believe, that people are playing in a lot of these high-end decks that can be installed face-down that legitimately will bluff. Or so much so to where, you know, a lot of the popular decks that we're seeing, if you play a card face-down, it's not taxing enough to warrant the runner actually going to get it. Like, if you play RP and I install a card face-down, I mean, the only cards I can install based on the standard agenda spread that I would normally run would be, like, either a 5-3 or a 4-2, right? So if you know that I run 5-3s and 4-2s, the card that I install on the remote is unlikely and is not likely an agenda, it's probably going to be the Caprice Niusei or an Asset Econ card. I've made a joke about that kind of scenario before, but, you know, to me it feels like a pro thing to do now, knowing that, is to take that 4-2 and throw it in the remote and do nothing at first. Just play the game. Just don't do anything. If against those kinds of matchups, people aren't expecting it to be an agenda, or they expect you to advance once to guarantee the score. When you don't do any sort of advancement, they assume it's just garbage. It's a padded campaign you're protecting. It's a sender you're protecting.
Well, this is also the advantage of that Netrunner has that a lot of other games don't when it comes to those tier one lists like you're speaking about there, Hollis, is that as a good player, you can take that list and you can change one card in it. And that can change that entire concept around. Like, you could install something on your first turn, and someone might think, well, I know that list, that's a pad campaign, because he or she wants to do this the next turn. And then, you know, it's not a pad campaign, it's something completely different that they weren't expecting. Or maybe they do run it, and it's a snare, or something like that.
And not trying to really theorycraft that much here, but maybe if some of the assets that we're seeing were a combination of proactive and reactive. Like, for example, you take a card like Reversed Accounts, I think that card's immensely underrated because, you know, just taking the runner's credits can be so strong. But maybe having something like a balance of that card where it's, okay, you can proactively install that card, advance it twice. If they don't touch it, you know, take 8 or however many advancements you're willing to invest in it to siphon the runner's credits, give it an added effect. When accessed, the runner loses 2 credits per advancement token. So it's less effective, but it still does something on access. So it's a bit better of an ambush card. It's a combination of like an ambush and, you know, reversed accounts.
Yeah, like hostiles? I think that's what they're called.
Yeah.
But, like, the issue with reversed accounts is that it requires a scoring window in and of itself.
No, but that's okay, though, because the point is to send people through your servers during the scoring window, right?
Sure, if you wanted to do that, yeah.
Yeah, and having the ability to signal...
If you wanted to bait them out, yeah.
Having the ability to signal that you're trying to score a Nisei or trying to score a Future Perfect, I think is a big sign. I personally, because it's already in faction, I would probably go for Brains Trust in that slot.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because I like to be able to play Brains Trust really, really proactively there and say, I'm going to score this a 5-2 and gain a massive economic advantage.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing you could do, like you're talking about in a replicating perfection list, is, as Hollis was saying, when the RP player is installing a card, everyone's used to them playing 5-3s and 4-2s. They're just going to install and they're like, that's maybe the Caprice Nisei. If that's a Brains Trust, you just score it out the next turn because they didn't bother to run there.
Yeah, that's it. Like, people have been conditioned quite severely into seeing this RP list a certain way. Mix it up however you want. Mix it up. Hollis, go for closed accounts. That's fantastic. Me, I'll go for Brains Trust. Brian, you'll go for, I don't know, Grindle Refinery.
Oh, yeah, okay. Sure, thinking. I'll take that one. Yeah.
But, I mean, I think the point is sound that, you know, you want to... That small changes can make a big difference, especially when they change something very vital, like, you know, how... That you, the idea that you can't score an agenda without having counters on it first.
Right. And I kind of, to piggyback off of something that Liam just stated, I feel like it's a combination of the availability of the cards and our mindset for how we plan to use those cards. And, you know, the thing is that I think that in my experience, in the highest tiers of play, people tend to play in a very safe way. Like, for example, if I play a card face down, you're going to calculate a risk of whether or not it's worth hitting that card face down. If you think you can take the, you know, knowing all the cards in the current card pool, if you think you can take whatever the worst case scenario is of that card face down, well, you'll hedge that bet, you'll run that card. In the case of, like, remote play, if I have two pieces of ice and I install the card face down, no advancement, then, and you know, again, this is about reading the current game state, so you're sitting at 8 credits, you're going to ask yourself, okay, well, clearly here, you know, I want to try to hit these remotes because it's sort of early game, or really closer to mid game if I've got two ice on that remote. I've only have 8 credits, though, so if I run that remote, and I know this deck normally has to advance first, if I run that remote and it's not anything, I'm actually going to end up being behind... on credits. So the biggest benefit that you'll get from doing a play, and I've talked about this before, install something crazy. Install a Future Perfect. Be ballsy with it. Install that. Don't advance it. Leave it alone. Your opponent is going to hedge that bet and say, all right, well, it's a Sundew. Can I afford letting him have that Sundew? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Play it, but play the game so that you know that you're going to actually hand them and feed them an agenda in order to be able to create a better scoring window. If they don't take that scoring window, you'll blow their mind on the next turn when you do something such as, like, hedge fund advance, because now an alarm goes off to them in their head. All right, well, I spent my last turn developing my board state. I may have less credits than I had, you know, less credits. And now I know that's an agenda. They completely tricked me. These are all very gamey, you know, things that you can't predict. But
yeah, that's actually a very interesting way of opening up a scoring window. I hadn't thought of that before.
Yeah, I think part of it is the mindset, is that, but competitively you play, I think, in a efficient and safe way that doesn't risk too much. And if someone is willing to be ballsy enough to sort of challenge that mindset, then you could, it's a bluff that could very well pay off. Not all the time, of course. And I think that, you know, it could just be a matter of, hey, they've used StimHack there. But I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea to, you know, to consider plays like that, especially when, as the corp, that the bluffing mechanic is like one of the strongest tools to your advantage.
100%. That's about all we have time for tonight in The Winning Agenda. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so via email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. You can check out our Facebook page, The Winning Agenda, and you can follow us along on Twitter @winningagenda. Thanks so much for being with us, guys, and thanks so much to Hollis Echo for coming along and being with us for the last 2 weeks. We'll be sure to have you on again soon.
Oh, thanks, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, we like having you over here in Australia. You should come visit us sometime.
Sure, it's not expensive at all.
All right, we'll see you guys next week as usual.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, sorry if I spammed too long, guys.